This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 36 days since the campfire started. Tonight, an important update on emergency shelters housing the pets of fire victims. If you haven't claimed yours, you need to do so soon. Plus, Airbnb's Open Homes program, assisting fire victims. And we hear about and from three people whose names are intertwined with this disaster. Paradise Mayor Jody Jones, Reverend Ron Zimmer of East Avenue Church, and Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey. We want to hear your questions and comments. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Friday, December 14th, 2018, this is After Paradise. The campfire raged so far, so fast, that thousands of people barely had time to get themselves out of harm's way. And finding and evacuating pets was an even greater challenge. For hundreds of those that did make it out, an emergency animal shelter has been home. And now it's becoming more urgent for owners to come and claim them. NSPR's Mark Albert spoke with Lisa Almaguer of the Butte County Public Health Department.
There's some changes coming up with animals who've been evacuated or rescued after the campfire. How many shelters are there now and where are they?
Yeah, so we have three shelters. We have one in Oroville at the Old County Hospital. We have one in Richvale. And then we have the large animal livestock shelter in Gridley.
So I understand they're being consolidated. What's happening and what's the remaining location going to be?
Last week, we consolidated the Chico Airport shelter animals to the Oroville shelter. There are some changes coming up. Yesterday, we announced a transition plan and target close date for the emergency animal shelters. So the three will remain open until January 4th.
And then after January 4th?
Animals that are unclaimed will then be transferred to local shelters and held for another 30 days.
So, and then after that, they'd be up for adoption to anybody, and that would be around February 3rd if it's 30 days?
Correct, correct. But, you know, like I said, that doesn't mean that animal owners have to come and pick up their animals. What it does mean is we need to hear from animal owners. We have about 1,050 animals total in all of the shelters. Most of those animals have identified owners, and then we are making every effort to connect with animal owners. We're doing three things. We're calling every animal owner that we have a number on file for. That means they brought their animal to the shelter during evacuation, and they provided their phone number. We are also sending reunification specialists to the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds where the human shelter is, seeing if we can locate shelter evacuees that may have animals at the shelter. And then we're also attending the many community meetings that are happening right now to see if we can connect further with animal owners. We're encouraging everyone to call the reunification hotline. That number is 895-0000.
So why are there so many animals left in the shelters? Is it that people can't bring their animals?
So there's a variety of reasons why there's so many animals left. And I think primarily it's just a very difficult time to make decisions. There are many folks that don't have homes to go back to. We have so many resources and so many ways to help connect people with a longer-term, more comfortable sheltering. We are here. We have a reunification specialist to work one-on-one with every owner and help them identify a long-term solution. We have a growing list of foster families and households that would like to temporarily take care of pets and give animal owners more time. There's also private boarding facilities that are available in the area. We just need to hear from folks and be able to connect with them. We know this is a hard time and many difficult decisions, and we have a lot of options that will be more comfortable and emotionally healthy for their animals.
And I understand there's been some controversy with some of the groups not wanting to close. What is that about? What are their concerns?
There's been a lot of chatter on social media, Facebook and Twitter. We've seen a lot of misinformation, specifically stating that if animals aren't picked up, that they'll be euthanized. And this is simply not true. Butte County Animal Control and North Valley Animals Disaster Group do not euthanize animals. nor do we send them out for that purpose. I know there's concern that some folks feel like the shelters are closing too soon. It may feel too soon for the animal owners, but we need to do what's best for the animals that are in these emergency shelters. Emergency shelters are different from more established local shelters that are always open. They were established for the immediate evacuation orders. And now that the fire is out and we have many evacuation orders lifted, there needs to be a next step for these pets, a more comfortable location for them to be for long term.
NSPR's Mark Albert speaking with Lisa Almaguer of the Butte County Public Health Department. Here in Butte County, the campfire displaced roughly 50,000 people who all had to figure out and are still figuring out where else to stay. Rachel Miro reports on a program that allows homeowners to help disaster refugees.
On the morning of the fire, with flames and smoke darkening the sky above Paradise, a very pregnant Melissa Johnson packed her whole family into two cars and fled down the hill.
At the time, it was my daughter, 14, and my son, who's 11. My father-in-law, he's disabled, and so is my husband. He's disabled as well. We had three dogs and a cat and a rabbit.
They all gathered at her sister's one-bedroom apartment in Chico.
So that night, we knew we couldn't stay there. It was just too crowded. And the closest place we could find was Redding.
Way up north. In less than a week, she spent $1,000 on hotel rooms before somebody told her about Airbnb's Open Homes program, which pairs hosts with disaster survivors in need of free temporary housing. At the same time in Sacramento, Cindy Dolphin signed up her spare apartment on Airbnb.
I was a bit skeptical that they would be comfortable in my house, but she said anything is better than where we are right now.
And it was a tight squeeze, but Cindy made it really lovely.
It was enough to get Johnson through until she found an apartment. Everything they have is donated, including a baby shower's worth of gifts for little Annette Marie. Born 10 days after the campfire started at a robust 11 pounds and 2 ounces, Cindy Dolphin, the Airbnb host, posted about Johnson's family on Facebook, and her social circle responded.
A playpen, a bedside sleeper. I just got this Christmas tree.
Melissa, Annette, Trevor, Jerry, Kalea, William, the Great Danes Lily and Penelope, the toy poodle Callie, the cat Damon Chewy, and the rabbit JJ will all celebrate Christmas here while they negotiate with their insurance company. Johnson plans to rebuild the Paradise home they ironically moved into 1 week before the campfire struck.
We still own it. What's left of it.
As for Dolphin,
we are so blessed and fortunate to have what we have, and if we can share it with others, just give them a place to regroup and plan for the next step, it makes a huge difference.
For the California Report, I'm Rachel Miro.
Amid all the devastation and destruction of the last few weeks, a love affair has been carrying on out in the open. Commentator Kim Weir says it's appropriate to the season.
It's a romance, a bromance, an ongoing best pals play day, all that rolled into one otherwise straight arrow relationship. It's funny, sweet, and so extremely unlikely, especially in such dark times, that you marvel at the odd magic of humanity. Through two immense disasters, the recent Oroville Dam spillway failure and full-scale evacuation, and the monstrous campfire, a catastrophe we're still beginning to live with, we have come to believe that Sheriff Honey is on our side, in a fearless yet fully human way, day after endless day in the wake of this last disaster, and our gratitude knows no bounds. We trust him because he's a stand-up guy, and he's standing up right beside us when it would be just as easy to sit down and hide behind some desk. In gratitude, and maybe a little awe, people started crafting superhero sheriff love notes and sending them all around on social media. Tongue-in-cheek Chuck Norris tough guy stuff on steroids. Honey is my homie. My personal favorite, though, is the black and white one where a stone-faced Sheriff Honey glances sideways over his shoulder, intoning the threat, "Say pleasure, one more time." But mostly, it's nonpartisan hero worship. His calendar skips April 1st because nobody fools Sheriff Honey. He sleeps with a pillow under his gun. When asked how many push-ups he can do, Sheriff Honey says, "All of them." His 10-gallon hat holds 20 gallons. His 2 cents add up to $37. And on it goes, with more and more of them all the time. People can't seem to stop. Sheriff Honey doesn't dial a wrong number. You answered the wrong phone. He once hit 11 out of 10 targets with 9 bullets. Honey was first appointed to the position of Butte County Sheriff in 2014, but he was a superstar early on, starting in the Sheriff's Department as a jail guard in 1993 and becoming a detective in just 3 years. His communication skills were always stellar, which caught the attention of the DA. District Attorney Mike Ramsey hired him as an investigator in 2005 and appointed him chief investigator after just a few years. Honey studied law, too, online, and passed the California bar exam on his first try, another heroic feat. But none of that is why we love our sheriff. We love him because he shows up when we need him, and even shows up when we don't need him, but just enjoy having him around, like the downtown Christmas tree lighting in Chico. When he's not chasing bad guys and rescuing people, he poses for selfies and public snaps and reaches out with a reassuring hug to anyone and everyone. According to one meme, Santa Claus is worried about landing on Sheriff Honey's naughty list. Funny, that Santa reference. On NPR's StoryCorps recently, a guy who runs a Santa school pointed out that teaching people to be Santa actually shows them how to be better people. Santa respects people. He looks them in the eye and listens, and he treats them all the same, whether they are 4 or 94. Now we know who Sheriff Corey Honey really is. You heard it here first, folks. He's Santa.
Kim Weir hosts Up the Road, airing Wednesdays and Thursdays here on NSPR. You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. We'll have more just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. On November 8th, the morning of the fire, Reverend Ron Zimmer of the East Avenue Church here in Chico walked across the church parking lot around 7:30, looked up, and saw a large plume of smoke and thought to himself,
"Huh, wonder what that is. This ought to be interesting."
By about 8:45, they knew it was a big fire, and by 9 a.m., the calls were coming in asking whether the church would be opening as a shelter. The staff put together 50 cots, just in case.
By noon, people were starting to show up, a little trickle at first, but by 3 and 4 o'clock, it was a pretty steady stream. And we just tried to put people somewhere. And we had no idea how many people needed shelter, how many people were going to find us. But we opened up and let them come in and try to figure out where to stick them.
Can you describe your space for us?
We have an aging gym in the back of our church. It's easy to put people in. We've got some showers and some bathrooms, locker room type, and a kitchen. That's the first place we put people. When it looked like we were going to get some families, we opened up our fellowship hall. And then people started coming in to camp in the back. People started setting up tents in our back field. We've got a couple of acres back there. And people were doing whatever they could do to come in and find a place to be while they figured out what the rest of their life was going to look like.
At that point, what are you doing? Clearly, this is a logistical puzzle.
Absolutely.
That has to be solved fairly quickly. What was your process?
Well, I called the three people I really needed to, somebody to come in and cook because all these people are going to need to eat at some point. We call people to come in and clean, and we call people to come in and do registration, find out who's here as best we could. And people started streaming in to volunteer, even that first night. People I didn't know, people that aren't involved with anything that we've ever done before. And people just started making decisions. I mean, part of my role was to grant people permission to make the decisions that they needed to make in order to get us to where we needed to go. All those decisions don't go through me. They never do. But certainly in this kind of a case, it's just like, yeah, do it. Whatever you come up with, let me know. So those first few hours were chaotic, but people came in. The right people were there to make the right decisions, and we got everybody in, fed, started to help people work through the process, help people work through the social side, not just the physical side of this whole process.
How many people did you have in those first 2-3 days? Do you even know?
We got up to 280.
280 people.
Yeah. And then it was a river after that. I mean, people would come in and people would go, even those first few days. So there were people that were with us for a few hours, for a few days, for a few weeks. But there are always people coming and going.
You mentioned that not only did you have to provide the basics of life, food, shelter, but—
Toilet paper,
yeah. But that, you know, I think what you mean by the social aspect is dealing with what these people were going through at the time. How do you provide, if not active counseling, but just enough presence for people who are in trauma? You're not the Red Cross.
Well, no, which actually I think means we can do more.
Oh, interesting.
Because we're able to put more people to work than the Red Cross is. We're able to take people who are volunteering out of passion rather than people that have been background checked and or fit into their box. I don't want to paint them in a bad light at all, but we got a Canadian couple that was on vacation with, well, a couple and their 17-year-old son, and they were traveling the Western United States, heard about this and said, well, maybe we should go and volunteer. And they showed up to the Red Cross. The Red Cross goes, well, you're Canadians. They can't do a background check on them the same way. So,
wow.
So they showed up with us and they're still with us helping out.
They are?
Yeah.
5 weeks later?
Yeah. Yeah. They're terrific.
So again, how do you provide that kind of social and emotional net with so many people at what is likely the worst time of their lives?
Yeah. Well, certainly collectively it is. We called people who do this for a living. We've got some connections and called some people to come in and to be a part of the team that's listening to people, that's helping people work through their story. At first, people just want to tell their story mostly. There's some people that want to hide. There's some people that want to be left alone. Some people that want to crawl into their shell. But every last one of them has a name. Every last one of them has a story. And we try to help people through that. And really, it's, you know, the 5 stages of grieving that people are going to go through. And one of our choices was to make sure that we didn't just pass people on to the next place, that we actually helped people to work through that grieving process, and so that they can get to the point where they're going to find out whether or not they have a home to go back to, where they're going to find out if their insurance has a place for them. They're going to work through the fact that they don't have insurance and they're waiting for a solution. The normal way that this happens is you just pass people from one shelter to the next until they all get coagulated into one group. And then you've just got this great big group of people who haven't spent any time together, haven't created community together, that are living side by side in a ship that definitely has an expiration date. So what we tried to do is give them a place where they could come to be loved, to find hope, and to reach some kind of a conclusion about what the next few months are going to look like before we just passed them on.
What do you take away from this experience personally?
Even like 2 weeks in, nobody knew what their life was going to be like, right? I mean, Nobody knew whether their house was burned or not. And I'm sitting in our gym talking to people about what they feared most. I mean, that wasn't my question, but that's what they were talking to me about. I was floored that no one had hope that they still had a home to go back to. Nobody. But they still had hope in whatever comes next. And I'm pretty overwhelmed by that. Overwhelmed by the gratitude of people that, you know, when I think I'd be all caught up in my own stuff. And yet they were so gracious and so grateful.
Reverend Ron Zimmer of the East Avenue Church here in Chico, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Jody Jones was supposed to take her sister's cat to the vet to get spayed the morning of November 8th. She got to her sister's place around 8:30 a.m. Then came the evacuation order.
And I look outside, and it's like pitch black, and everyone else is gone, and I'm thinking, I have to leave. I did not think the town was going to burn down.
Her husband was at their home in a different part of Paradise.
And so he's driving the motorhome out. We lived in kind of East Paradise, and I'm coming from the north. And we just said, well, I'll meet you in Chico. And about then, the cell towers went down, so we didn't talk anymore. But it took both of us 3.5-4 hours to get to Chico through the flame, just like everyone else. Flames on both sides. Certain places you could feel the heat inside the car.
They both made it out after crawling for hours in traffic. Their house burned. Her sister's house burned. Her husband's office burned. And Jody Jones had to start figuring out what to do about the city of Paradise, because she's the mayor.
I did go back to Paradise and see it because they gave me a tour because I was the mayor. So we went by my house.
And how many days after the fire was that?
That was on Friday.
Oh, it was the next day?
It was the next day, yeah. But I knew it was gone already. I was prepared for that because when you have two houses that close to yours already fully engulfed, I just didn't think there was any way it would still be there.
And what about seeing the town itself?
That's hard to take. It's actually gotten harder each time I've gone up. I don't know why, but the first time it was like maybe I was numb. And now I'm feeling more emotions about it. It's encouraging to me, and I try to focus on what is still there because there are some really key things still there. Town hall, the police department, the 2 fire stations out of 3, 2 grocery stores out of 3, and the whole shopping center around those grocery stores. The library is still there. So I've been in meetings with the business community and the U.S. Secretary of Labor. So we're focusing more on the future, and that's encouraging.
Have you made a decision about whether you will rebuild there?
Or oh, yes.
Was it even a decision to make?
We made that decision the afternoon of the fire. Mm. Yeah, we're going to rebuild.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When you start thinking about the town coming back, the question that arises out of any crisis or trauma like this is, will you take the time to see if you can make Paradise better than it was? Or is the urgency so great that you simply get it back up as fast as you can?
I think it's a balancing act, and we are going to go through a planning process. Many times when you do a general plan, a planning process takes 2 or 3 years. We don't have 2 or 3 years to do that. People want to go home, but we have an opportunity to do things better, to look at some of our streets so that we have better evacuation routes, to look at our building codes so that we have more fireproof structures in town, those sorts of things. And we are going to do that in an open public process that will probably start after the new year. But we have months to do it, not years. We probably have the time that it takes for the debris removal to go through that process, because once all the debris is removed, people are going to want to pull their building permits, and we want to be ready for that.
When you look at rebuilding an entire town, What goes through your mind in terms of how to rebuild the community? How do you bring back a sense of what paradise was? Or do you simply move forward and see what paradise will become?
What paradise was the people. How friendly it was, how much volunteerism there was, how much people gave back to the community, all the events that we had, Johnny Appleseed Days and the ladies baking the pie. It was all about the people. So how you bring that back is you show them that we can rebuild this town so that they want to repopulate. It's the people we need to get back. And I understand it's going to be a smaller town. Not everyone is going to come back. But the people who do will set that tone for what our community is going to be like. It's all going to be new. It's going to be beautiful. Other people who haven't lived there before are going to want to live there. But we need to have that community spirit so when they move in, they join us.
Obviously, you have faced, as the mayor of Paradise, extraordinary challenges over the last 5 weeks. Has there been anything that surprised you?
Last night, I went to a firefighters' appreciation dinner that was put on at the Palms for all the firefighters who had and their families who had worked here. And I've been able to kind of keep it together the whole time, but I sort of lost it last night, which was a little bit of a surprise to me, but I'm just so grateful for what they did. You go up to Paradise and you look around and most of what you see is burnt, so you might say, why are you grateful to them? They saved all of our people. And when I was evacuating, it took me 3.5 hours to get out. So I'm driving very slowly and there's fire on both sides and I'm kind of looking around and there's no fire trucks. And I'm thinking, nobody's fighting this fire. And then I see all of these firemen helping people. They focused on saving lives, which is the most important thing. And they pretty much got everybody out. And so that's what I tried to tell them last night, how much I appreciated that they saved the people of Paradise.
What is your message for the people of Paradise at this point in the process? Obviously, it's going to be a long haul, but what do you want them to know about how their government is operating, how the planning is going?
I want them to know that the staff is working 16-hour days very hard to try and get things done so that they can get back and see their homes. I know there's a lot of impatience with that. We're hoping very soon to have an announcement that people can go back. I also want to say don't lose heart when you do go back and you see what it's like, because we are going to rise from the ashes. We are going to be newer and better. And we can rebuild this community together. Paradise strong.
Mayor Jody Jones, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that is our program for Friday, December 14th, 2018, 36 days since the campfire started. We're produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. Adam Ragusea composed our theme music. Special thanks to Matt Fidler. This is our last daily edition of After Paradise. Starting next week, you can hear us each Thursday evening at 6:30. Thanks for being with us tonight and over the last 3 weeks as we formed this program. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.